Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I trust by now you're all in the swing of how Mises University works. It's demanding, but it's fun. And so there's always a lot of camaraderie after the first day or two as people get to know each other and start learning from one another and sharing their experiences. And it's fun for me to be here. I get to meet a lot of people I didn't know before. And as it turns out, I have a Facebook page because, frankly, my wife insisted. And after she insisted, I found that I enjoyed it. And she always knows what's best for me. And so I have many Facebook friends, and some of them I know only from Facebook. I've been able to see here in person, so that's very nice too. Glad for the opportunity to be here. Always enjoy this meeting, probably more than anything else that I regularly participate in. So it's a lot of fun for me to be here. And the shame is that when I come here, I talk about things that are not fun at all, because. My specialty among the Austrians, I suppose I could say, is death and destruction. And it's just not an uplifting topic, but that's what I've had occasion to work on from the very beginning of my career, actually. Before I got my PhD, I worked as a research assistant for one of my professors who was studying the diphtheria epidemic in the North American colonies in the 1740s. And so I got to pour through old records of deaths. And I've been pouring through records of death ever since in one way or another. I'm going to talk about quality assurance this morning. When we in economics talk about goods, we often don't describe them in any detail. We just refer to an automobile or a pair of shoes or whatever we use as an example or illustration. But in reality, of course, even the simplest product has many dimensions. There's no such thing, in a sense, as a simple product. If you wanted to buy a potato, that seems like about as simple a product as you could purchase, but a product can be distinguished according to its size and its color and its shape, its moisture, its taste, its texture. You know, there's just many dimensions to even the simplest product. Now, many products, it turns out, are beneficial, of course. That's why we call them goods, but they also have attributes that may be harmful to us or may be, let's say, the cause of some lapse in their serviceability to us. They may have defects of some sort. And for some products, these defects can be very serious indeed. If you buy an automobile and the defect is that the steering wheel may fall off, well, you need to be very concerned about that possibility. And if you use, for example, a pacemaker to keep your heartbeat regular, you need to be very concerned that it will operate properly and control your cardiac arrhythmia rather than set it in motion, say, a malfunctioning device might do. So there are dangers, there are risks, there are defects associated with the products. And for that reason, people seek not only information about other attributes of products, such as their price, but they want some assurance as to the quality of the specific product that they are purchasing. And we know, of course, that the regulation of product quality has been going on for at least 1,000 years. Back in medieval days, the guilds undertook to regulate the quality of various goods, including textiles, in considerable detail. And these guild examples used to be brought out by teachers to illustrate just how foolishly extreme regulations might be. But I guarantee you that the detail of the medieval guild regulation is nothing in comparison with the detail of thousands of different kinds of regulation modern governments undertake. There are whole cities, such as Brussels, that busy themselves with the creation of ever more detailed product regulations. And Washington, D.C. has quite a number of people busying themselves in that way, too. Now, what I want to do this morning is talk about the Food and Drug Administration, a regulatory agency which has been, or its ancestor agency has been, in operation for over a century in the United States. The original federal regulation of food and drugs was the product of something called the Pure Food and Drugs Act of 1906. So this sort of thing has been going on for a long time, but it's been going on with ever-increasing complexity and severity and cost and consequence. And so I want to go into this because medical goods, drugs, and medical devices are very good examples of the problems of quality assurance. In the case of these kinds of goods, we want to really be sure that the drug we're taking will be helpful and not harmful, not toxic, not something that creates side effects that are so horrible they're worse than the disease we are seeking to cure or remedy in some way. But what we find here is that although this, in a way, seems to be the good that most justifies government regulation, it's almost the other way around. When we look at how the regulation takes place, we find that if we could get rid of regulation anywhere, this is probably the area where we would want to start, because this is the area where the regulation turns out to be most devastating. Okay, I wrote an article, a very Austrian article, so not all my articles are so Austrian as this, but this was published in 1994 in the Review of Austrian Economics, and it has a long, clumsy title called Banning a Risky Product Cannot Improve Any Consumer's Welfare, Properly Understood, with Applications to FDA... testing requirements. Long enough for you? Okay, I apologize for that title, but you know, after that, you don't really have to read far in the article. So there's a bright side. If you were suffering from a serious disease, would you prefer A, that you and your doctor decide how to treat your ailment, selecting from all existing medical goods the ones that offer the best combination of benefits and risks, or B, that you and your doctor select from all the medical goods except those, probably the most promising ones, that a low-level government employee in Rockville, Maryland, has decided to withhold from you? Well, the answer is obvious. Rational people would never consider themselves better off because their range of choice had been arbitrarily limited. Yet such restriction of consumer choice affecting both patients and their physicians fetters consumers at all times in the United States. The Food and Drug Administration alone decides whether a newly devised medical good, either a drug or a device, may be sold. Many potentially beneficial goods remain on the shelf for a decade or more while their manufacturers traverse the rigid and elaborate testing process required by the FDA before it will approve marketing. While innovative medical goods run the bureaucratic gauntlet, people who could have benefited from their use suffer and die unnecessarily. Defenders of the government's action insist that without the FDA's regulations, greater harm would occur. Consumers would suffer from the toxicity or adverse side effects of unsafe products, or they would squander their money on useless remedies. Consumers can avoid these injuries if they are permitted to use only medical goods that have met high standards of safety and efficacy by passing successfully through the FDA's testing requirements. The Food and Drug Administration carries out a multitude of functions, and here I've listed only some of the major ones. This agency regulates, of course, drugs and food, but also medical devices, cosmetics, pet foods, vaccines, biologic products, you name it. There's a whole list of products FDA regulates. They account for 20 to 25% of all consumer spending if you add up the product categories subject to FDA regulation. So it's a terribly important regulatory agency with great scope. For drugs and medical devices, they require, as I've indicated, reports of many types. They require pre-market approval before a product can be sold. And in order to get that approval, products have to pass through an elaborately defined testing procedure with many stages. At each stage, delays are common and changes in the requirements may be made. In fact, that's almost universally the case. And for a typical new drug nowadays, the time required to pass through these testing phases is 10 to 15 years. And the cost, on average, is now in excess of $1 billion. So if you've got a startup in your garage and you want to place your product on the market, be prepared to have some very well-heeled venture funds at your availability. After products are on the market, firms are required to follow up on them and to make reports of any problems. At all times, their manufacturing processes are subject to excruciatingly detailed regulations. And finally, of course, after all of this, when your product is on the market, the FDA may simply order you to remove it. So this is an extremely powerful agency, and if you could see what goes on at a firm in the drug or device industry, you would find that a great deal of it has to do with taking actions only in order to fulfill FDA requirements or to prepare required FDA reports. And this is a gigantic paperwork operation, and most of the violations that FDA finds in the firms have to do with some misstatement in the paperwork, almost always an inconsequential mistake of some kind. Well, in testimony before a congressional committee, an FDA official said the following: "The allegation has been made that the cost to our society to prevent a thalidomide-type tragedy far exceeds the benefits of a regulatory system developed to prevent such a tragedy. We disagree. We believe that benefits which accrue to society because of our regulatory system are worth the costs and far outweigh any risks," end quote. This statement, which expresses the agency's standard line, is remarkable in at least five ways. First, it uses the most notorious medical tragedy of modern times to illustrate what presumably the FDA's regulation routinely prevents. The presumption is indefensible. Except in a freakishly unlikely case, one may not reasonably assume that an unrestricted manufacturer would sell a medical good giving rise to a thalidomide-type tragedy. Besides their ethics, Manufacturers have good financial reasons, including product liability judgments and loss of consumer confidence, to be careful about what they place on the market. Second, the statement I quoted stands alone without any attempt to demonstrate that the lives saved and the suffering prevented exceed the lives lost and the suffering endured as a result of the FDA's regulation. It is merely a naked declaration, which the audience presumably should accept because it emanates from the self-proclaimed experts. And I emphasize self-proclaimed because the agency invariably represents itself as the gold standard of quality assurance. That's its term. It uses it over and over. You see, gold standard has some supporters left in the world. Third, the statement speaks of the benefits and costs of the regulation as if they were experienced by society at large rather than by specific individuals who differ enormously in their personal valuation of the costs and benefits and in their willingness to bear risk. It rests on the unspoken assumption that a single rule should apply in all cases, mocking the actual heterogeneity of people's preferences and medical conditions. Fourth, the statement confidently declares, "We disagree and we believe," while describing the balance of benefits and costs experienced by others. But only specific individuals can possibly know whether the benefits to them outweigh the costs to them. Neither the benefits nor the costs can be objectively assessed by third parties, nor may the benefits and costs experienced by many individuals be aggregated into total or social valuations and thereby made comparable. There is no common unit of account in which the aggregation may be made. Who knows how to measure the depth of one person's fear, the breadth of another's relief. Fifth, the statement presumes an answer, the wrong answer, to the question posed by AIDS activist and FDA critic Martin Delaney, quote, "Who should decide which risks are acceptable, the bureaucracy in Washington or the patient whose life is on the line?" In the beginning, the FDA had a fairly limited scope of power, and over time, that power has grown relentlessly. It's almost impossible to identify any retrenchment of the power. But it's helpful to understand how that power has grown as having two almost distinct aspects. One, the trend movement, as it were, and another, the crisis changes that take place from time to time. What I've got in my diagram is a kind of schematic representation of how the regulatory operation proceeds. And if you look at those solid arrows, the wide arrows, starting at the top of the schema, where the news media and the Iron Triangle politics interact with one another and give rise to expansion of FDA powers by issuance of new regulations and more detailed regulations. That's what you would think of as the normal day-to-day operation of the agency. These Iron Triangle politics show up, of course, wherever we have government regulation. The congressional committees that are responsible for the statutes that authorize the regulation remain involved. The regulatory committee itself, and then all the interest groups that arise because they are affected in one way or another by the operation of the regulation get involved in the process as well. Sometimes these might be people whose stake is as direct as patients' groups. The bulk of the involvement is by industry groups because their very existence and their financial viability turns on how these regulations are shaped. And sometimes opportunists are attracted You've all probably heard of Dr. Sidney Wolfe and the Center for Science in the Public Interest. They show up whenever there's a claim of some product defect or some bad drug or some toxic food. And this is a Nader Group spinoff, and it's been around since the 1970s, and it's a front group for trial lawyers. They bankroll it because every time the Sidney Wolfe people show up claiming that there's some horrible defect in a product, you can be sure that a lot of product liability suits will follow as day follows night. So this is a way that trial lawyers gin up very profitable business for themselves. But there are many other interest groups that get involved as well. Now, that goes on relentlessly. It's going on all the time, day and night, 365 days a year. This is one of the things, by the way, that I'm always emphasizing to people who think that when they take on the government, this is going to just be a matter of kind of spreading the word and convincing the people, and then we'll just knock down the government. You're up against millions of people who are well paid to specialize in keeping this government power in operation and making it grow. You're up against a Leviathan. That's not just a turn of phrase. It's a reality. And here we see it in one of its worst manifestations. So it's a very difficult thing to take on head on in any way. I know a number of people who've tried to do it, and I'm afraid I must report that almost all of them have been knocked down and some of them ruined by the attempt to do so. Okay, the people who make decisions at the FDA respond to incentives, just as people do elsewhere. The bureaucrats prefer to advance in their careers. They don't want their incompetence or blameworthiness to be exposed. In their circumstances, FDA examiners may err in two different ways. Type 1 error, the examiner does not approve a product that is safe and efficacious. And type 2 error, the examiner approves a product that is not safe or efficacious. And naturally, the examiners want to protect themselves from criticism arising from their commission of errors. Examiners' incentives to avoid a mistake, however, differ greatly for the two types of error. As a former FDA inspector described the situation, quote, "Anytime you approve a new drug, you're wide open for attack. If the drug turns out to be less effective than the original data showed, they can nail you for selling out to a drug company. If it turns out to be less safe than anybody expected, some congressman or a newspaper writer will get you. So there's only one way to play it safe. Turn down the application. Or at least stall for time and demand more research." See what's going on here? One man's incentives are not compatible with everybody else's incentives. Because such demands for more research, new drug applications now commonly consist of two or more volumes of summary data and as many as 100 volumes of raw data, sometimes more than 100,000 pages altogether. Although such heavyweight requirements help an FDA examiner to, quote, play it safe, they often result in much avoidable suffering and in many deaths among the patient population awaiting access to the good. Unfortunately, the news media, members of Congress, and self-described consumer advocates almost never hold the bureaucrats responsible for these so-called invisible or statistical deaths. Hence, the cost of a single bureaucrat's career insurance may be, and in some cases certainly has been, tremendous sacrifice of human health and life. Consider, for example, that from 1963 to 1973, quote, the FDA's doors were essentially closed to cardiovascular drugs. Even though cardiovascular disease was the leading cause of death in the United States, and rapid advances were occurring during those years in pharmaceutical therapies, Beta blockers, an especially valuable class of drugs, awaited FDA approval for a decade after they were first used abroad. Dr. William Wardell, a professor of pharmacology at the University of Rochester, estimated in 1979 that a single beta blocker, alprenolol, which had already been sold for 3 years in the strictly regulated Swedish market, could have saved more than 10,000 lives a year in the United States. 10,000 lives a year might have been saved by a product that simply sat awaiting FDA approval. Other examples given by Wardell include years of delay in the availability of at least 4 respiratory drugs that caused severe disadvantages to many asthma sufferers, as well as a 6-year lag in the availability of valproate in particular, and the continued absence of nitrazepam that substantially reduced the treatment options for epileptic patients. Lithium carbonate, an effective drug for the treatment of manic depressive disorder, was used in 40 countries before its approval by the FDA. A 1980 study by the U.S. General Accounting Office examined 14 therapeutically important drugs introduced in the United States between 1975 and 78, and the analysts found that only one of the 14 had become available first in the United States. For the others, the lag in availability ranged from 2 months to 13 years. Astonishingly, the FDA has given little or no weight to foreign evidence of product safety and efficacy. Nearly all new drugs and devices have been forced to pass through the same rigid, expensive, and time-consuming testing procedures in the United States, even though a product might already have been used successfully for many years elsewhere. Economists Henry Grabowski and John Vernon at Duke University made many studies of the pharmaceutical industry. Considering the results of their own research along with the findings of other studies comparing the experience of various countries, they concluded that, quote, U.S. citizens have experienced sizable foregone health benefits from regulatory-induced delays in obtaining beneficial new drugs while obtaining relatively modest benefits in the form of less exposure to drug toxicity. Perhaps the most damaging consequence of the FDA's regulation since 1962, when the testing requirements were made much more rigid, elaborate, and time-consuming, is the slowdown in the rate of innovation. In view of the high costs of securing FDA approval to market new products, many manufacturers conclude that otherwise promising R&D projects will not be profitable. As a result, beneficial new drugs and devices are never created. Suffering and death that might have been prevented continue unabated. Of course, since the innovations never come into existence, hardly anyone appreciates that they, the persons, have been sacrificed on the altar of regulation. I want to say just a few words about the rule of law. We talk about that quite a bit among freedom-loving people. The rule of law means much more than the requirement that the legislature authorize an exercise of power by the executive branch of government. Classical liberals understand the rule of law to require that the law be clear and understandable, that penalties for violations be predictable, and that the law be applied equally to everyone, including members of the government. FDA's actions, though broadly sanctioned by legislation, fail to satisfy these criteria. In stark violation of a genuine rule of law, the FDA's actions are frequently arbitrary and capricious, sometimes even blatantly unconstitutional, as when they restrict freedom of speech, and they do in many ways. All product advertising has to meet FDA approval so that every word you see or hear spoken in an ad is there as approved by the FDA. If you ever wonder why these TV ads for drugs have a lot of rapid-fire caveats attached to them, sometimes taking up more room than the product claims, It's because the FDA requires that content to be included. In the medical device industry, where the FDA has conducted a jihad during the early 1990s, manufacturers remonstrated that their cited violations of the agency's good manufacturing practice regulations often arise because the regulations are vague. And I quote here, even companies that genuinely try to comply fully with U.S. GMPs, the manufacturing regulations, can find themselves cited for violations. Companies whose products are esteemed by consumers have been forced to stop production because their paperwork did not satisfy the regulators. Health Industry Manufacturers Association complained that the FDA, quote, has not made clear the type of data it wants to see. Therefore, companies must make a series of information submissions, hoping that something will satisfy the regulators. Sometimes the FDA requests one type of study, then changes its requirement and requests another type after the company has completed the first one. The director of the Manufacturers Association, Allen Magazine, describes the device approval process as, quote, a giant guessing game. Remember the rule of law? Here we have a giant guessing game, but with severe penalties for violations. Supplicants can expect no reliable guidance by asking the FDA what is required. Sometimes they won't bother to return your phone calls. The agency does not respond to inquiries expeditiously, and when it does, the response often lacks substance. Moreover, after years of countermanding the informal device given to regulated parties, the agency announced in 1992 that it would no longer be bound by its own formal advice. Indeed, the head of FDA's drug surveillance branch said the following, quote, we used to say that if a company made certain changes, then we would probably not take any action. Now, we won't. Now, even if they make the changes, they might end up in court. We want to say to these companies that you don't know when or how we'll strike. We want to eliminate predictability. End quote. Rule of law. That a so-called civil servant would make such a statement is stunning. That kind of statement could only be made under tyranny. Recourse to the courts, which is costly, time-consuming, and full of uncertainty, holds little promise of protection in view of what Wardell has called the extreme vulnerability of the industrial firm that argues with the FDA. Without a search warrant, the FDA may inspect a company's plant and records at any time. Because the regulations are so numerous and so often vague, the last time I looked in the Code of Federal Regulations, 8 volumes were filled with FDA regulations then in force, and I guarantee you they're highly detailed. Inspectors can always find violations if they want to. In short, the agency possesses the power to destroy a company at will, to retaliate for past resistance, or to make an example by closing down the firm's operation or seizing its property. They do both of those things fairly frequently. So much for a genuine rule of law. There's a place for paternalism. It's in the family, where young children are incapable of making wise decisions for themselves, and where a parent linked to the child by bonds of love and responsibility may normally be relied upon to decide what is best for them. But when paternalism becomes a form of government, when the individual freedom and responsibility of competent adult citizens are suppressed in favor of exclusive decision-making by a central planning board, no one should expect a healthy outcome. For more than half a century, Americans have been forbidden to make important decisions regarding their own health, decisions on which each individual's life and death depend. Of course, we've been assured by those who wield the power that they act only in our best interests. But anyone who makes even a superficial study of the FDA, its regulations, and the congressional overseers quickly discovers that the official line is far from the truth. This government agency, like all the others, is a political institution, swayed by the ceaseless quest of its leaders for position, publicity, power, privilege, and perquisites, all associated with a big budget and a far-reaching agenda. It's a mistake to suppose that the FDA acts or even attempts to act so that, all things considered, suffering and loss of life are minimized. Instead, responding to the asymmetrical incentives created by the reactions of the news media, certain members of Congress, and so-called consumer advocates, FDA officials systematically strive to avoid type 1 errors while disregarding, avoid type 2 errors while disregarding type 1 errors. Not relishing the negative publicity sure to follow their approval of medical goods that later cause harm, even relatively slight harm, they adopt the role of obstructionists, requiring ever more stringent, expensive, and time-consuming testing before allowing goods to reach the market. That avoidable suffering and death routinely occur while they drag their feet and protect their careers does not sway them, because hardly anyone holds them accountable for the harm caused by their type 1 errors. Okay, at this point, I want to not exactly retrace my steps, but to come at the topic from a slightly different angle. As I've said, risk attends the use of medical goods, whether used for diagnostic or therapeutic purposes. The consumer may suffer directly because of adverse side effects or indirectly by using a good instead of a more beneficial alternative. Mainstream economists commonly attribute the, quote, excessive harm to imperfect consumer information and characterize the conditions giving rise to such harm as market failures. These economists conclude that government provision of information and government regulation of the terms on which medical goods may be sold or used can remedy the failure and produce a more efficient allocation of resources. This way of thinking about the issue is incomplete and seriously misleading. In fact, two kinds of risk exist. There is, to be sure, a risk of harm from using the good. But there is also a risk that, denied access to the good, consumers will be harmed because alternative medical goods are less effective in curing or ameliorating their conditions. I call the first kind of risk use risk, and the second kind prohibition risk. Obviously, the two vary in reciprocal relation. The more the government diminishes people's exposure to use risk by limiting a good's availability, the more it exposes them to prohibition risk, and vice versa. Notwithstanding the common characterization of the problem as one of imperfect consumer information, the underlying risks cannot be banished by decree. They are inherent in the state of scientific knowledge and technical skill. The vital issue here is how to optimize exposure to the two kinds of risk, balancing the two to maximize the welfare of consumers. My concern now is to analyze how the allocation takes place under government regulation of the sort carried out by the FDA and to contrast that system with the allocation under an unimpeded market process. My general conclusion is that the market brings forth a superior outcome, especially in the long run. It's instructive to consider this issue along the lines pioneered by Mises and Hayek and developed further by their Austrian school followers in the analysis of central planning. From this analysis, we know that socialism cannot succeed if by success one means the attainment of maximum feasible satisfaction of consumer wants. Information about resource endowments, technical constraints, and consumer preferences is dispersed among the population. Moreover, this information is always in flux. Central planners have no effective means of collecting the relevant information. Even if somehow they could collect the information, it would be obsolete by the time they could implement plans based on it. Ever-changing consumers' preferences cannot conceivably be known by central planners. The consumers themselves do not know exactly what their preferences are until the moment they act upon them. They have demonstrated preferences, but notwithstanding the usual assumption of neoclassical economics, they do not have a stable, all-encompassing indifference map in their minds. It would be pointless for the government to conduct a survey to discover people's preferences. Opinions are one thing. Demonstrated preferences, in which consumers necessarily bear real opportunity costs known only to them, are something else. And they are the only preferences that count in the maximization of consumers' welfare. This kind of analysis can also be applied in considering the allocation of risks associated with medical goods. Only individual consumers who are free to seek whatever professional advice or other information they consider worthwhile can evaluate the risk of using a medical good and the risk of not using it and determine the point at which, weighing the two kinds of risks, they judge the use risk to be acceptable. Consumers alone are in a position to compare the prospective pains and pleasures inherent in the decision and to determine whether the risk of not using the good outweighs the risk of using it. Others have no way to intuit or simulate judgments of this kind. Only the risk bearers themselves know the scale of values on which the opposing risks are weighed, the units in which the prospective disutilities of risk bearing are measured. If outsiders presume to make the decision for those who actually bear the risks, the intervention represents nothing more than a pretense of knowledge, for which Hayek indicted the economic planners, macroeconomists, and neoclassical welfare economists. The intervention compounds the ignorance of consumers' true preferences with government coercion. To believe that such heavy-handedness can improve consumer welfare is sheer paternalism and very bad economics. Apart from the fundamental incapacity of government regulators to solve the relevant allocation problem, it's folly to think that they would do so even if they could. Public choice theory and careful observation alike teach us that regulators tend to seek their own interests rather than the, quote, public interest. To preserve their budgets and their prerogatives, they respond to the dictates of their political overseers. Elected politicians who seek re-election and self-aggrandizement and do not shrink from twisting the truth and burdening the public in that quest. Knowing that the polity responds disproportionately to crises, politicians and bureaucrats exploit numerous events such as the elixir sulfanilamide tragedy in 1937 and the thalidomide affair of 1962 to justify great expansions of their authority. As a rule, they employ their powers with heavy emphasis on the short term, readily sacrificing longer run and widely dispersed benefits for immediate, concentrated, and often specious benefits for which political credit can be claimed. In making decisions that allocate use risk and prohibition risk, the regulators systematically regard the former and disregard the latter. The imbalance makes good sense for them, regardless of its unfortunate consequences for the consumers. If adverse side effects cause serious or widespread harm when consumers use a government-approved good, those who approved it will be held to account by the news media and congressional overseers with consequent jeopardy to their bureaucratic careers. Regulators, therefore, as we have seen, are loath to approve any good until it has undergone extremely exacting tests, which typically require more than 10 years to complete. Other countries, as I've noted, often allow the marketing of new drugs and devices long before the FDA approves their sale in the United States. In contrast, if people suffer preventable harm, even if the suffering is extensive and lethal, while a medical good undergoes an extended period of mandatory testing, the regulators are unlikely to be identified by the media as responsible for the suffering. And many people will be unaware that a potentially beneficial good is being kept from the market. In fact, almost everyone will be unaware. It follows that the number, stringency, and expense of the required tests, all of which are correlated with the duration of the test period, exceed the levels preferred by many consumers who consider the prohibition risk as well as the use risk. Now, note that consumers who prefer more information than the government requires are not affected, as they can voluntarily wait until enough additional information has been adduced to satisfy them. Notice, however, that in making the good available to those already willing to risk its use hastens the day when sufficient information will have become available to allay the doubts of those currently unwilling to bear the use risk. Most of the real information about these products arises only after they've begun to be used widely. In sum, the regulators systematically impose requirements for marketing approval that lengthen the test period beyond that at which at least some consumers prefer. When the government has the power to approve or disapprove the marketing of a medical good, political jockeying comes into play to resolve people's differences in belief and risk evaluation. Those who prefer to use a good immediately cannot express their preferences by means of market bidding. They must resort to politics. Hence, afflicted citizens testify before congressional committees, and disease victims sometimes demonstrate in the streets, while political action committees and executives of drug and medical instrument companies make large campaign contributions to office seekers. None of this would occur if the benefits, costs, and risks of medical goods were allocated by a market process. Under the current regulatory regime, heavy fixed costs must be borne by producers to gain FDA approval for marketing their products. The effect is to penalize disproportionately both small companies and projects to develop products with relatively small markets, for example, so-called orphan drugs, abandoned by developers because their expected revenues are too small to justify the costs and delays imposed by the FDA approval process. This is especially unfortunate because small companies are often the most innovative. Many medical goods return attractive profits only because of their patent protection. When long delays separate the granting of the patent from the FDA's approval for marketing, the present value of the net income expected from the investment in research and development is diminished, and the R&D effort is correspondingly discouraged. When R&D is reduced, as it has been especially by the 1962 amendments to the drug laws, consumers are denied the benefit of improved and, in many cases, safer products. The longer the elapsed time before the products receive widespread use, the more delay occurs before the availability of more reliable estimates of potential risks. Most of these risks are so small that you need a very large sample of users before you can really identify it with any precision. Ironically, the FDA's regulation may increase not only the prohibition risk in the short term, but also the use risk in the longer term. Much of the public's approval of government regulation of medical goods, and the public overwhelmingly does approve FDA and its regulations. It's probably the most popular of all regulatory agencies. Much of the public's approval springs from a failure to understand how private institutions would operate in the absence of such regulation. Many people fear that without the government's watchdogs, consumers would be deluged with harmful goods and unable to identify fake procedures and quack medicines. This unsavory vision of the unregulated market process owes more to progressive ideology than it does to sound theory or history. Even in today's heavily regulated context, private sources of research, products, information, and advice do vastly more than the government to remedy the public's ills. Absent the regulation, these sources would flourish even more. There is no need for government to assure the safety or efficacy of medical goods. No need. People who are concerned about such matters can look to any number of private sources, and they will readily pay for the sorts of information they actually value, as opposed to the kind of information used only to justify depriving people of the right to make their own decisions about their own health. Medical and pharmacy associations, for example, might reinstitute certification schemes for drugs and devices, like the Seal of Acceptance Program the American Medical Association operated between 1929 and 1955. Private information sources such as the Medical Letter on Drugs and Therapies, Health Devices Alerts, World Medical Device and Diagnostic News, Journal of Emergency Medical Services, MD Byline, and countless others are already circulating widely and could be greatly expanded. Private organizations such as the Consumers Union, the publisher of Consumer Reports, and the Consumer Federation of America could do much to inform the public regarding medical goods. The American Association for Retired People might redirect some of its activities from lobbying to advising the elderly about medical goods. Manufacturers themselves, if legally free to do so, would have a strong incentive to provide information about potentially harmful or ineffective goods offered by rivals. Trade associations could establish and police standards. Quality could be certified by an organization such as Underwriters Laboratory, a private organization that currently tests electrical appliances to ensure that they meet strict standards. Insurance companies with policies covering manufacturers for product liability judgments could play a much stronger role in the absence of the FDA. Now, I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about what might happen in a free market future. I'm talking both about that and about what is already happening in the world we live in now. Because the FDA does not do what it claims to do, people have had to develop private alternatives, and they have done so. It's those sources to which people actually look. When you want to work in a hospital and buy a medical device, you don't look at FDA reports. There are much better sources of information. They tell you about product quality, problems that might arise, problems that have arisen in the past, and so forth. Those are the sources that people go to. I have encountered one such source, which is especially remarkable. ECRI is a nonprofit organization that's been operating since the 1960s. Most of its activities are located north of Philadelphia. Originally, these letters stood for Emergency Care Research Institute, but they gave up using that name and just used the letters, ECRI, because, in fact, they do a great many more things than work on emergency care. They work on all sorts of things. And I've got a few slides here which are actually cut and pasted from ECRI's website. But what I would urge you to do, just as an example of what has already been done, is just call up ECRI on a web search and spend some time looking at their pages. It's just astonishing what these people do. I got acquainted with Dr. Joel Noble, the founder of this organization, back when I was working on the FDA as my major research topic in the 1990s, and he's a remarkable man, and his organization is even more remarkable. It receives no money from the government whatsoever. It receives no money from the industries that manufacture the products it studies. It's completely independent. Its specialists in all kinds of scientific and technical fields are highly competent, which cannot be said for FDA employees, notwithstanding their gold standard claim. They're often the people who know least about the products they decide on. But ECRI is an astonishing organization. As you can see, they have many clients, including, note, the U.S. federal and state government agencies. It's a little bit like when the government hires the private security firms to police their properties, you know, because the government cops won't do it effectively. Governments as well as many private organizations and institutes use the services of ECRI. They issue all kinds of reports. They make studies. And when people have product problems, they can take their problem to ECRI and have ECRI experts assess the problem, bring to bear the information they have from other reports, and get expeditious, competent responses that help them solve their problems. What you get from the FDA is not an expeditious, competent solution to your problem. You get potential prosecution under federal law. What a system. It's designed to discourage actual problem solution. In any event, the manufacturers have a strong incentive to maintain high quality in order to avoid the large penalties assessed by the courts in tort cases. At present, many such private activities, although by no means all, have in effect been crowded out by the operation of government agencies. Okay, let's conclude. The two most important questions in any economic analysis are, one, what is the alternative? And two, what happens then? And then, and then. Unless one has carefully considered free market alternatives, one is not justified in concluding, as most mainstream economists have, that government regulation of medical goods, including marketing certification only after rigidly structured, very expensive and time-consuming tests, improves consumer welfare. Of course, such regulation does diminish use risk, indeed, by prohibiting all medical goods entirely. Legal use risk could be wholly eliminated. A moment's reflection on that absurd extreme may explain what is wrong with emphasizing use risk and ignoring prohibition risk. Whatever means one finds preferable for allocating the risks, the analysis is incomplete until one inquires into the ensuing consequences. Not only the immediate ones, but the increasingly remote ones likely to flow from the chosen institutional arrangements. Government regulation inevitably leads to politicization, and its evolution reflects the shifting distribution of political power. Market processes permit consumer preferences to drive the allocation of resources in their inputs, outputs, and risks. Over time, one can expect government regulation to feed on itself and to ratchet upward with each notorious medical tragedy. Over time, one can expect the market process to respond to consumer feedback via the price system and to encourage the types of product innovation and information transmission consumers actually value. Of course, the market process will not produce nirvana. Risks cannot be banished. Inescapably, within the limits set by technical, institutional, and human constraints, they must be borne. Even in a free market, regrettable choices will sometimes be made. Tragic events will sometimes happen. But apart from the more promising long-term developments one may realistically expect from the market process, one must ultimately face up to the moral dimension of the issue. As the health scientist Samuel Broder has said, it's not good for people to be put in a situation where they are begging for their lives from a central government authority. End quote. Thank you very much.